At the weather tonight, increasing clouds, lows 43 to 56, cooler in northeast Minnesota. Tomorrow, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in northwest Minnesota. Partly sunny with highs 71 to 77, evening temps 49 to 57.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
In poor health, the director of the American Public Health Association voices his support for staff at the Centers for Disease Control as extreme cuts to funding and staff departures threaten that agency and the well-being of the people it is supposed to protect.
And strumming up support, Joe Hickerson was a well-respected musician in his time, but a fellow folklorist tells us he was even better known for his contributions to the preservation of American folk music in the archives of the Library of Congress.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
You are tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo. Serving the area since 1916, more at AtchisonTire.com. The nonprofit iLink Minnesota helps those with low vision and blindness by providing technology-based solutions. You may find more information by searching for iLink Minnesota. That's I spelled E-Y-E. And we receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org. Now I'm going to play a song for you. Spoon just released two new songs, and I'm going to play one of them. This one is called Guess I'm Falling in Love.
Make it a thing. Nobody can say it enough. Like they couldn't prove.
And that Spoon with Guess I'm Falling in Love.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Sleepless and helpless, overnight Russian missiles battered Kyiv, and all our guest could do was cower in a hallway and hope that none of them would hit her apartment building.
A serious risk of complications. The director of the American Public Health Association tells us chaos at the Centers for Disease Control spells trouble for health professionals and for the well-being of everyone in the country.
Sung hero, the late Joe Hickerson, was a folk singer-songwriter, but his greatest contributions to the genre happened behind the scenes in the archives of the Library of Congress.
Learning curveball. The back-to-school season will look different for some students in Manitoba as wildfire evacuees prepare to start the year in classrooms far from home.
Clause at effect, Felix Perry was on everyone's nice list for bringing a big beard and a bigger heart to his role as a mall Santa to children in Nova Scotia.
And wasteland. A Winnipeg hill built on a garbage dump has become a beloved local landmark. Thanks to a newly repaired sign, it's been immortalized as Garbage Hill. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that welcomes a little trash talk. It was a rare strike at the very heart of Kyiv. Starting last night and into this morning, waves of Russian drones and missiles rained down on the Ukrainian capital. A five-story apartment building sustained a direct hit. The attacks killed 21 people, including children. They also damaged a building housing the EU delegation and the Kyiv offices of the British Council. President Volodymyr Zelensky said it was a clear sign that, quote, Russia chooses ballistics instead of the negotiating table, unquote. Maria Druska lives in the Kyiv neighborhood that was attacked. That's where we reached her.
Maria, first of all, let me ask you, what are things like right now, tonight?
Tonight, it seems to be calm. We're not expecting another massive attack after what we have experienced this morning. So tonight, people, I believe, still recovering after last night and this morning. And I believe the works are being ongoing on the sites aftermath of this attack.
These ballistic missiles came down very close to your home. What did you do when you first heard the sounds of the attack?
Actually, the air raid started around 9:30 in the evening, you know, and first Russians launched drones and a lot of drones to weaken our air defense. And I've heard that first, but it was around like 10, 11. And after that, I think I had a 2.5 hours of good sleep before they started launching ballistic missiles on us, you know. And those explosions, they happened around 3 in the morning. And it was just all of a sudden I woke up. And you know, Neil, this sound, you can't, it's just completely different kind of sound. You can't mix it with anything. It's very powerful and it's very terrifying when, you know, windows are shaking and your whole body is shaking. So that's, I was asleep, of course, by when it started.
And you know, in all of the conversations we've had, it's a uncomfortable reality for people now. They've become accustomed to those kinds of attacks. It doesn't mean they're not fearful of them, but when did you realize? I mean, it sounds like at that 3 a.m. moment, you realized that this was different even than what you've experienced before.
First of all, it happens so fast that you can't even move. Like you realize that it is too late to run somewhere to the shelter. For example, me personally, I used two walls rules and I grabbed my passport when I heard those big explosions. I don't know why passport, probably as it came to my mind later, I grabbed my passport, you know, I hold it on my chest and I went to the corridor using these two walls rules and thinking whether it will be my house next or not. And I thought, I had a thought, you know, if I happened to be under the rubble in the morning, and first responders were getting my body out of the rubble. At least they will have to see my passport and identify me faster. You know, it's really scared that people have this actually thoughts. You know, it's not normal.
The two walls rule you mentioned, the fact that you know that others there know that. Just tell our listeners what you've been taught on that front.
Most of people now, they go to the subway and spend their nights in the subway, you know. But since next morning we have to go to work anyway, sometimes I just neglect this. And that's why I use two walls rules. Means you use a corridor or a bathroom, because if something hits you, it would rather hit and destroy the first wall where the window is, right? So you would be protected with the wall either to the corridor or that lies goes next to the bathroom. And actually today when I saw those videos, these two rules walls saved two ladies. As far as I remember, they were two ladies. So their kitchen was destroyed, windows crashed, but they used those two walls rules and they were saved.
The building that was hit, can you describe, you know, who lived there, what it's like, what your neighborhood is like?
Yeah, I live in a regular residential area. It's big residential area, actually, on the left bank. It was five-story building, and the whole block was damaged. And it was just horrible. When I was looking and watching those videos, you could see and hear sounds of people screaming to rescue them for help. And first responders were doing their best. But, you know, it was just terrible, because closer to the morning, like as of now, I think, well, just a few hours ago, it was known about 17. Now it is confirmed 21 people who were killed. And among them, there were four children, you know. And when you realize that children were just peacefully sleeping at night and Russia killed them, just brutally murdered them in the sleep, you just can't comprehend it, can't handle it, you know. It's difficult.
What do you think the message is that Russia is trying to send with this strike?
You know, for us, for Ukrainians, Neil, it's very clear, because these nights that we live through, this terror again and again, it's very clear to us that Putin has no intentions of ending this war. And what is most important, I think, that he makes fools of world leaders, because just some time ago, he told President Trump in Alaska that he wants to stop killings, but he continues killing Ukrainian children. Then he said that he is someone who is seeking for peace. But as we see, this behavior is a behavior of a liar, not someone who is seeking a peace.
What do you think would finally bring peace?
Well, you know, some leaders believe that it's not enough to impose real pressure on Putin or to cut off his war machine, his war economy that fuels this war, even after today's terror, you know. So what bring peace? First of all, the real pressure is needed on Putin, on Russia, the real strong sanctions that would cut off their funding of this war. And only by unity, only by pressure, serious pressure, it would help to bring peace closer, you know. And that's what we Ukrainians fear. Not only we fear ballistic missiles, but we also fear world leaders don't put enough pressure, because so far it has been only promises, you know.
Maria, I very much appreciate your time. Please stay safe and take care.
Thank you so much, Neil. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
We reached Maria Druska in Kyiv. The first day of school is always nerve-wracking for students and their parents. New teachers, new homerooms, new classes. But hundreds of kids in Manitoba are facing an extra anxiety this year. They're also attending new schools in new cities. The threat of wildfires pushed entire communities away from their homes. And while the fires aren't an imminent threat right now, Manitoba Hydro says it's going to take until mid-September to clean up the damage and restore power in some communities. In the meantime, the Brandon School Division is preparing to welcome students who've been displaced, including paying visits to hotels where evacuees are staying. Matthew Gustafson is the division superintendent, and we reached him in Brandon, Manitoba.
Matthew, the first day of school, I don't need to remind you, is less than a week away now for students there. How do you feel in terms of how prepared you are?
Starting the school year is always a bit of a mad rush any given time. And so this year has a few additional things to consider. So that adds a little bit to that. But we're optimistic about the school year. Mm-hmm. And it's always nice to see students coming in and parents dropping their children off for that excitement of it all. And this year will be no different.
How many students do you have under normal circumstances?
Our student population increases each day. Mm-hmm. We have quite a growth, but at the end of the year, last year, we were over 10,200.
So I ask because I wonder how many students that have had to leave their homes because of the fires. How many new students, how many more students are you taking on now?
Well, we are not completely sure of mm-hmm. the total number of students because there is still some, this is an evolving situation as communities are still assessing their ability to return, or families that may be displaced and living with relatives or some in hotels. So with this much flux and uncertainty, we'll be assessing the total number of students through our conversations with communities and families as it's ongoing. We are anticipating somewhere around the 150 to 200 students. But again, that's a number that may continue to change.
Right, that's understandable, given the circumstances. I know members of your team, your staff, have been going to the places, hotels, for example, where evacuees and their families are staying. What kinds of conversations are they having? What are those families telling your staff?
Our conversations have been a lot around the planning pieces and working with community or school personnel and families. So some of that is all in the trying to get a sense of the needs. We have had some parents indicate wanting to get registered and that excitement of that. And I think we would also anticipate, though, that there would be some parents that may be anxious and not sure. And so that we anticipate there would be a range of mm-hmm. emotion.
Yeah, and our CBC colleagues there in their reporting have talked to some families, some parents who are hesitant about sending their children to city schools. It doesn't feel like home, they've said, and they're not sure about the timelines, right? So they're not sure that they should be putting their children in schools away from their communities. How are you and your team addressing those concerns?
The most important part is to acknowledge that and be respectful of those concerns. And so that's where we feel it's important to take our lead from the families and the affected communities. And so as such, we're trying to do a range of scenarios that we can implement at any point and try to be flexible and adaptable to their needs. I don't think it would be a generalized that all evacuees would have the same perspective. And so we're going to try to adjust and use members of the community to help us understand what it is that we can make that transition as seamless as possible.
Would setting up classrooms closer to or in the hotels that they're in even be, or bring teachers to those areas? Would that be possible?
Yes, that's some of the range of scenarios mm-hmm. that we've put in place if it was needed. And so what we try to do is be able to have a set of scenarios that we could set up classrooms, whether in schools, where you can have access to the playground and other equipment, or if parents are uneasy, that we could implement that in a different setting for them. It's also making sure we have the supplies for them to be successful. things like nutrition, making sure that we can adjust our nutrition supplies mm-hmm. to where the population may be. And then also trying to take all the guesswork, have transportation ready for those students so that they can get to school and take off one thing from parents.
You're always busy at this time of year, Matthew, no doubt. But, I mean, do you have time to even sleep and do what you need to do?
I think the one thing we're continually trying to reinforce that these families and students are in our community. They're our students. And so this is not, this is something that we have an obligation and we feel it's an important part. And so it's not an extra thing to do. It's just part of what we need to do.
As exciting as the first day and the first week of school can be for little kids in particular, especially if you're in a place that's not home, you don't know your classmates, maybe it's even more anxiety-inducing for them. What have you been able to, what are your team members doing to try to allay their concerns? We've been talking a lot about the adults and how they're feeling, but it is about the children too.
In some of the planning, it would be our intent to try to set up classrooms that would mirror the community schools where they may be returning at some point. So then that creates less of a transition. So in other words, if going into a class where you don't know anyone creates a degree of anxiety, creating a class with your classmates and a teacher that's has lessons and units that can, you know, also transition back to the community if they're able or when they're able to return, can minimize the impact of those transitions and help student achievement and reduce anxiety.
I know you've been in contact with provincial officials as well. Have they given you any kind of timeline for when these students and their families might be able to return to their homes?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm comfortable in, because there's a lot of factors that would go in timelines. They've given us some general pieces for that, but our approach is because we don't know all of the details around the return of utilities like hydro and maybe the state of the communities, including the school and the homes. We're trying to create plans that can go for any length of time that's required. Mm-hmm. And then be able to pivot back into transition back into their homeschools if or when that is mm-hmm. able to happen.
Matthew, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Yes. No, it was a pleasure.
Matthew Gustafson is the superintendent of the Brandon School Division. He's in Brandon, Manitoba.
So while we're here with our friends so dear, we'll drive dull care away. Away, 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 away. We will drive dull care away. And while we're...
That is Joe Hickerson singing one of his favorite songs, Drive Dull Care Away. Every folk singer and folk fan knew it, but Mr. Hickerson really knew it. He knew the whole story of pretty much every folk song, where it had come from and when, how the lyrics and tune had changed over time, and any other pertinent and not necessarily pertinent detail about it. Joe Hickerson was a singer himself, as you heard, but it was his work at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress that changed how folk music was remembered and archived. Mr. Hickerson died earlier this month. He was 89. Steve Winnick is a folklorist at the center and was a friend of Joe Hickerson. We reached him in Washington, D.C.
Steve, I know you knew Joe Hickerson for a very long time. What did he tell you about why he loved folk music so much?
Well, I remember, you know, he said that one of his early experiences was seeing Pete Seeger in concert and just being fascinated both by the old traditional songs that Pete was reworking and by the, you know, new and modern folk songs that Pete was singing. And they just, to him, they were the most exciting songs that he'd heard, and he wanted to find out more about them. And so that sort of started his journey of learning about traditional songs and then, of course, learning to play them.
And so as you said, he was inspired by Pete Seeger. How did he then end up writing two verses to Seeger's Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Well, yeah, I mean, so it essentially just started where he heard Pete's song and thought about it a little bit and thought, you know, so essentially the song is talking about how first the young men disappeared because they became soldiers, the soldiers disappeared because they went to the war, et cetera. So all of those, and the flowers disappeared, right? Mm-hmm. Where have all the flowers gone? And he brought it full circle. So the song kind of ended in the middle of where we now think of the song, the cycle of the song going. And Joe realized that having those, you know, that having it come full circle rather than ending in the middle would make sense. And so he wrote a couple of extra verses for it, and Pete Seeger really liked them, and so that became the song.
Did he tell you, did Joe tell you what that meant to him? I mean, just for anyone, whatever field you're in, to go from being inspired by someone to then writing on an iconic song.
He was really, really excited by it at the time and remained very excited by it for his whole life. In fact, I seem to remember that his business card used to actually say, I wrote the last two verses of Where Have All the Flowers Gone on it. So, yeah, so that was one of his, he definitely felt that was one of his great claims to fame.
And I love that he didn't think he needed to be, or that he should be, modest about it. Is that a hallmark of his personality?
Right. Well, yeah, although I think it was to a certain extent, but also it was his personality wasn't, he didn't seem to be egotistical about things like that. He seemed to have a childlike excitement about them, right? So he was so happy about this that he had to tell everyone, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
So there was the performer in him, but then there was the person who was clearly committed to preserving this art form and making sure people knew about it. How would you describe his contribution to folk music in general?
Well, I think that a lot of people know a lot of songs because Joe promoted those particular songs. And that worked both as a performer and, you know, through his archive work. So he would recommend songs to performers who came to visit the archive, and if they wanted to hear particular songs, he would find them what he thought were the best versions and sort of let them hear three or four different ones and really, you know, give them history of the song so that they would continue to work on them. So I think that was one of his great strengths and contributions, is that a lot of people in his generation and after, they know the songs they know because of Joe Hickerson's work.
What did he think they meant to the United States overall?
Well, I mean, I think he thought that they were the sort of true embodiment of American culture, right? Of and particularly working class, ordinary people's culture, as he might say. And that's what he was attempting to convey all the time. So the history of these songs is sort of social history rather than being the history of you know, the wealthy and powerful. And so he was, you know, always interested in promoting that, both on the level of the old traditional songs and on new songs that were being written from that perspective.
What did he teach you in the time that you knew him?
Well, a number of different songs and a lot of information about individual songs. I would contact him when I had a tough reference question or when I wanted to know something about a song that I was researching or a song that I wanted to sing. And he always had, you know, in addition to the sort of formal history of the song, he had funny anecdotes from the archive, like, you know, the time that three sisters whose last name was Short married three brothers whose last name was Long. and he was like, oh, yeah, that was sung in the archive by Mrs. Short, who was, yeah, or by Miss Short, who later married Mr. Long, you know. He always had stories like that about the singers and the people that we documented in the archive.
An encyclopedia, for sure, it sounds
exactly,
like.
Exactly, yeah.
We heard, our listeners heard a moment ago, Joe Hickerson singing Drive Dull Care Away. Did he tell you anything about why he loved that song, what it meant to him?
Well, he liked it because of the message and the good humor within the song. He also knew a lot about it, and when he first heard it, it was actually from a collection that was made by Sandy Ives, who was a folklorist up in Maine, and the singer was actually from PEI, so it's a Canadian song in that sense. And as I said, it's just the good humor of it. I think he liked the message of that song as a kind of summary of what he did with folk song, right, to drive dull care away. So he actually used that as the title song of some of his albums, just because, you know, that's what he thought he was doing with traditional song when he sang them.
Steve, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
Steve Winnick is a folklorist at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress and was a friend of the late musician and archivist Joe Hickerson. Here's another song from the folk revival Mr. Hickerson had a hand in. He's credited as a composer on this one, the Kingston Trio's version of Bonnie Heelan Laddie.
Was you ever in Quebec,
Bonnie Laddie, Heelan Laddie,
stowing timber on the deck,
Bonnie Heelan Laddie.
Was you ever in Dundee,
Bonnie Laddie, Heelan Laddie,
there's some pretty ships you'll see,
Bonnie Heelan Laddie. Hey ho and away we'll go, Bonnie Laddie, Heelan Laddie, hey ho and away we'll go, Bonnie Heelan Laddie.
This Boston town don't suit my notion and I'm bound for far away, so I'll pack my bag and sail the ocean and I'll see you on another day.
Was you ever in Mobile Bay,
Bonnie Laddie, Heelan Laddie,
loading cotton by the day,
Bonnie Heelan Laddie.
Was you ever round Cape Horn,
Bonnie Laddie, Heelan Laddie,
with the lion and the unicorn,
Bonnie Heelan Laddie.
And it won't be long and I'm bound for far away. You'll take a look around and find me gone and I'll see you on another day. Was you ever in Monterey,
Bonnie Laddie, Heelan Laddie,
on that town with 3 months' pay,
Bonnie Heelan Laddie.
The Kingston Trio with Bonnie Heelan Laddie.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, the director of the American Public Health Association tells us what the brutal cuts and staff departures mean for the Centers for Disease Control.
And we'll pay tribute to Felix Perry, who failed in at the Bedford Mall in Halifax when Santa Claus himself couldn't make it. He's being remembered as a man with a lap of steel and a heart of gold. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
We'll meet again this coming June and I'll see you on another day.
Hey ho and away we go, Bonnie Laddie, Heelan Laddie. Hey ho and away we go, Bonnie Heelan Laddie, Bonnie Heelan.
It is 6:35 and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Michelle. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about the dinner menu is available at Timberlake Lodge Hotel, KAEXE.com. Support for KAEXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Weather tonight, increasing clouds, lows 43 to 56, cooler in northeast Minnesota. Tomorrow, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in northwest Minnesota, partly sunny.
The website for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control describes the agency as, quote, the nation's leading science-based, data-driven service organization that protects the public's health, unquote. But several top officials claimed the CDC is not able to deliver on that mandate anymore, which is why yesterday four of them resigned. And meanwhile, the White House says the director of the CDC, Dr. Susan Meneses, has been fired from the position after just 1 month. Caroline Leavitt, press secretary for President Trump, said this about Dr. Meneses' tenure.
This woman has never received a vote in her life, and the president has the authority to fire those who are not aligned with his mission. We're going to make sure that folks that are in positions of leadership there are aligned with that mission.
Obviously, there are a lot of questions now about who exactly is in charge at the CDC. Tonight, there's a report that a top advisor to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is next in line for the job. The chaos at the agency is alarming public health officials and healthcare workers. Dr. Georges Benjamin is the executive director of the American Public Health Association. We reached him in Washington, D.C.
Doctor, how would you characterize the impact of the resignations of these doctors and the general, I mean, chaos is I think a fair word to use right now about what's happening at the CDC. How would you characterize the impact of all of that?
Yeah, the impact of all of these has made the agency very dysfunctional. Chaos is absolutely the right word. And it's based on a series. This is the climax of a series of things that the administration and in particularly the Secretary of Human Services has done to undermine the functionality and the authority of the agency.
What will this, what, how does this trickle down to the kind of work that you do?
Well, you know, I'm as an average citizen, when I go to a restaurant, I want to make sure that the food is safe to eat. That if I do get sick, there's somebody who can figure out what happened to me and make sure it doesn't happen to anybody else. I can't assure that anymore. The water's safe to drink, the air's safe to breathe, the things that public health does each and every day are managed by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They fund a lot of the programs for our state and local health departments. That funding has been cut. And without solid, evidence-based, well-trained leaders in these scientific positions, we are concerned about the ability to trust what comes out of the agency.
In one of the resignation letters, one of the doctors writes that, you know, just simply enough is enough. And one of the things they're highlighting is that vaccine advisors appointed by RFK were, you know, bringing in policy without, were making recommendations before reviewing any data. Are you aware of those allegations and what they're basing those allegations on?
Well, those allegations are true. Basically, what they've done in several situations is come out with the answer that they want and then backtrack to figure out how to get there. They did that on their decision on Thimerosal, and they're now doing that on their decision on COVID-19 vaccines for people under the age of 65 and for kids.
So what are medical professionals, doctors in their practices to do in this environment?
Well, you know, we're going to have to now rely on our professional societies to help us develop these standards and do like we did before the federal government got into this business many years ago. And organizations like mine, which are professional societies in public health and in medicine, we're going to have to be the people that support that and make sure that everybody understands what those standards are and make sure that they're followed.
Are you confident that this administration, this president, will listen to you?
You know, we're going to make them listen. You know, I've been doing this for a long time. And whether it's through the courts, whether it's through getting public sentiment, getting the public to understand what the risks and the harms are, what they're doing. And in the past, you know, the public has demanded things. This administration has been forced to listen.
So what is your message to the public and patients who, I mean, this is going to be confusing and upsetting for people wherever they sit in terms of support or not support or supporting the administration. This sows a lot of fear, I think, for people and questions at the very least. So what would you say to Americans, the public, potential patients?
You know, yeah, the good news is that we're a trusted voice and we're telling people, look, you're going to have to go. You're going to have to figure out who you trust. Are you going to trust the people that are interested in your health and your well-being? Are you going to be interested in people who don't have that interest for a variety of reasons? Some power-based, some because they can make money off of it. Some because they, you know, some of these people have true beliefs that are not scientifically based, and we're just going to have to expose them for the fact that their views are not scientifically based. And what we want to do is give people the right information so they can help make informed decisions to improve their own health. And we're going to continue to do that.
What did you think when you heard about those resignations? Did you think, were you surprised by it?
You know, these are folks that have stood in for some time. They have put up with a lot of stuff. And I know those folks, and I know they're strong, principled individuals. And so what I understand, because I know them, is that it took a lot to get them to make that decision. And of course, they did that collectively because they felt it was important to send a message.
Doctor, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Listen, thank you very much. This is a tragic time for our nation.
Dr. Georges Benjamin is the executive director of the American Public Health Association. We reached him earlier today in Washington, D.C. The last time Patsy George saw her son, Jonathan Hooker, he was just a baby. Now he's 52, and they've been reunited for the first time in decades. During the 60s scoop, Mr. Hooker was taken from his biological mother and her northern Manitoba community. It's hard to imagine he could have wound up living any farther away from that community. He was adopted by a family in New Zealand. It was only through DNA testing that he learned the truth about his past. And on Wednesday, Mr. Hooker and Ms. George met at the Winnipeg Airport.
I'm happy to see my son. I thought I would never see him again. He was only 2 months old when they took him away from me. And my other daughter, a month old. I don't know what they were doing. But I'm happy to see him, and I was kind of scared. Because I didn't know what he was look like. Because I'd seen him when he was only 2 months old. I couldn't believe it when he climbed down from the stairs.
I guess dealing with it emotionally, I guess, is probably the hardest part. It's not only what I've had to deal with, my family's had to deal with, and all the other families that lost their children to the 60s scoop. That was definitely pretty heartbreaking. So, and to know that I was part of that. Like, you always see stories on the news and that, it doesn't bother me or affect me or relate to me, but this is actually dear to my heart. And so hopefully somebody else, again, will see this and hopefully maybe start looking for their family, or it'll give them some clues to reach out and help. Through my adopted parents, they were always pretty open about things. I always knew that I was adopted. I guess up until a couple of years ago, I didn't really fully understand how it all played out. They were all pretty sugar-coated the whole lot. I didn't understand it. I didn't know anything about the 60s scoop until probably about 5 years ago, and then I've only really, in the last year or so, really learned actually how it all played out and how the RCMP were involved and all that sort of stuff. Like I say, I didn't know because I lived on the other side of the world and the news from Canada is very limited. I was lucky, I guess, with my adoptive parents. They gave me enough information and they sort of filled in a few of the spots. But the last 5 years, I guess, it's really started to happen. You know, I've sort of made more of an effort to find my way home.
Patsy George and Jonathan Hooker speaking to our CBC colleagues at the airport in Winnipeg. Is there a sign more iconic than the Hollywood sign? That probably sounded rhetorical, but it wasn't. And the answer is yes, there is. It's the sign that stands in Westview Park in Winnipeg. Big white letters that spell out Garbage Hill. Now, to give some credit to Los Angeles, which will get all sulky otherwise, yes, it is modeled after the Hollywood sign. But obviously it's an improvement on the original, not to mention a helpful and efficient way to explain that the hill was built on a garbage dump. The sign is beloved locally, partly because it's funny, and partly because no one really knows exactly who made it. So when it was vandalized recently, the current owner of the sign, Shane Story, knew he had to fix it quickly. Except, someone had beaten him to it. We reached Shane Story in Winnipeg.
Shane, so you hiked up to the sign to fix what was damaged. What did you find when you got there?
So we make our way down to the sign, and sure enough, it, very fresh, because there was some silicone on there that was still wet and everything, is four letters that somebody has gone and and got some puck board or something, and later we found out just from Home Depot, but
right.
All of a sudden, we see these letters sort of half fixed. I mean, it's not the professional style that we would have done, but
sure.
It was from a view, from far away, it looked just as good. So we ended up having to spend probably 45 minutes just taking it back apart.
So good news, bad news story, I guess, there. Who did this? Who did the DIY?
So we had no clue. We assumed it's somebody with some interest or good Samaritan, but we didn't know. So we, by the time we had taken apart his stuff, we sort of were getting close to lunch, so we went and had lunch. After lunch, we go back to start finishing up the job just again so that we can be ready in the next morning just to make it look as simple as possible. And lo and behold, up walks David. And he's got another plastic letter in his hand that I guess he was bringing and thought one of the other letters needed to be reinforced.
Which letter?
I think it was an A he had in his hand.
This is David Fielder. He's just someone who lives in the area?
Yes, correct. Yes. I mean, you guys know more than me. I didn't even know his last name, to be honest, until somebody reached out. But yes, he came up and introduced himself. Great guy. Obviously healthy like an ox running up and down this hill all the time. And I guess he just had a personal connection to it and thought maybe it wasn't going to be fixed or it was taking too long in his liking. And he just took it upon himself to take a run at it. Unfortunately, I was literally about 12 hours away from fixing it professionally.
Right. And how did he feel about you taking it apart to fix it professionally?
He couldn't have been kinder. Couldn't have been a nicer man. Very nice, actually. And of course, in the Winnipeg fashion, I think maybe his wife was my sister's teacher or something like Manitoba is just the smallest place ever. So if you sit with somebody and spend a couple of minutes talking, there's normally not that many degrees of separation.
The fact that he would go to the trouble, that he wanted to fix it so much or was worried about it being fixed, speaks to the connection that he and others there have. And I mean, it might be hard for people listening elsewhere to wrap their heads around, because calling something garbage is usually not a compliment. There isn't garbage mm-hmm, there, mm-hmm. right? The photos I saw, it's a pretty hill. So what is it about this that people love so much?
Well, to be honest, just to backdate it, it literally is a hill built on a pile of garbage. So, but Winnipeg is also eclectic in that sense that we find stuff funny sometimes that others don't, whether it's names of our food or where we go drive out of town to go get a hot dog somewhere. Or, I mean, we have Dancing Gabe, which is, you know, again, only a Manitoba phenomenon. But so Manitoba's got a quirky, interesting sense of humor.
What's a Dancing Gabe? Tell us that first.
Dancing Gabe is in Winnipeg. There is a gentleman who for, I don't know, 25 or 30 years has shown up to every single sporting event, and he dances and puts on a show for everybody.
Well, the producers are currently checking to see if he's been on As It Happens, because I'd be surprised if he hasn't, but he will in the future.
If you Google him, he shows up everywhere. But it's just one of those things, unless you live in Winnipeg, you would kind of go, huh? Why is that amazing? And you're like, well, if you're from Winnipeg, it's just the coolest thing ever, because it's, exactly, you get it. So that's the garbage hill would fall under that scenario.
The sense of humor, though, I mean, just the creation of this sign in the first place. This was not a city-sanctioned sign. Tell our listeners how it first showed up in 2018.
Long story short is a gentleman just on his own whim had decided that he was going to make a sign called Garbage Hill and stick it in Garbage Hill. So now I don't know if that sign hung out there a couple of days or maybe 1 week, but it was a very, very short amount of time. But in that time, a lot of people took pictures of it, took themselves with it, and kind of it very quickly became interesting. Well, fast forward a week or so, and the city worker shows up there and just starts folding and smashing the sign apart.
Oh, no.
And I think that's what really, I mean, if it had just disappeared quietly one day, but to see somebody just smashing it and literally folding it in half, just like it was garbage, I think just kind of outraged people. So it was, all of a sudden there was this like, hey, you're wrecking our public art, even though, you know, it wasn't at all publicly sanctioned. Yeah. But again,
prank,
when
really.
It, yeah. Exactly. It was totally 100% a prank. And the guy that did it, and I still don't know exactly who it is, but he said that. I mean, he wanted it to do it just for his own interest, for his own humor. He had a connection to the Hill, had spent a lot of time there as a kid and wanted to do it. So all of a sudden, the news is blowing up that the city of Winnipeg is the worst people ever, and they've destroyed this poor man's public art. Well, I had just finished, SRS Signs had just finished doing the Winnipeg sign, our local big sign like most cities have. So I had been dealing with a lot of city permits, people, engineering, and even possibly the mayor through it all that he was involved in it. And so all of a sudden I got a phone call that sort of said, hey, you know what, Shane, you just finished the Winnipeg sign. You're familiar with all the procedures and people and so forth. So can you do something with this sign? So next thing you know, I am recreating somebody else's public art or prank, whichever one you would like to call it.
It's not a bad thing to have in your legacy, the Winnipeg sign and the Garbage Hill sign. I mean, you're woven into the fabric of the city.
Thank you very much. I'm pretty proud that I am part of the legacy of this city, and I probably will carry on after I'm gone.
I appreciate this, Shane. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Shane Story is the owner of SRS Signs in Winnipeg. That's where we reached him. It takes a special kind of person to sit patiently while dozens of kids jump on your lap. Some so awestruck they can't speak, some terrified and sobbing, and most loudly declaiming a list of the exact toys they want in eye-watering detail. Santa Claus is obviously one of those people, and Felix Perry was another. He was known in Halifax as Santa Fee. For 15 years, he suited up as Santa Claus at Bedford Place Mall, posing for generations of Haligonians' holiday photos. He always had the requisite twinkle in his eye, but he took the role seriously, so much so that during the COVID lockdown, he pivoted to home visits. Here's Mr. Perry speaking to the CBC in 2020.
I've had customers that have been coming to me every single year, like I've watched them bring in their babies. One came right from the hospital, actually, one year, brought their... And year after year, they've come back to me, and I've seen their pictures, and some have even brought in their pictures, of 14 years worth of pictures of their kids from the time they were babies to the time, you know, they're teenagers.
Felix Santa Fe Perry talking to the CBC. Mr. Perry died on Sunday at the age of 71. Here's his daughter, Wanda Perry York, talking about the tributes that have been pouring in.
It's a lot right now because I guess we always saw him as our father and our grandfather. We did see him as Santa as well, but he played many roles. So to see the outpouring of love from every outlet right now, it's a lot, but not in a bad way. We've been reading each and every post, and it's kind of comforting to know that the joy he brought to others.
I'm sure it must be, you know, I can't imagine that, you know, you as have so many memories and, you know, love him as your dad, and then to have almost his other activities and other, you know, legacy.
Well, we know that, and we knew that we shared that as well. I mean, we would go even to campgrounds in the summer, and if me and him were taking a walk, you know, the kids would just follow us behind in a parade, and he kept his little beard, and even in the summer he had candy canes that he'd hand out to the kids and tell them to be good and give them a wink, like... He always had that special role about him.
Even in the summertime. So he always had his white beard. Yeah.
Always. He did home visits with my daughter for the past 3 years, and she was Candy Cane the Elf, and the two of them would go in his little Jeep and go everywhere in Metro. After the grandkids came, that's when he started. Yeah, when the grandkids came, he bought a suit, and he was just started one Christmas with them, and it never ended. It just carried on into mall and to home visits and volunteer work and school visits. My husband's going to be taken over, not this year, but maybe next year, and doing volunteer work and visiting the family with his suit.
Wanda Perry York, daughter of Felix Santa Fe Perry, who died on Sunday. She was talking to the CBC's Haley Ryan. Listen, I definitely do not want to poo-poo the incredible finds in Alberta's Dinosaur Provincial Park over the last century plus of excavations there. But given that the area is frankly absolutely lousy with dinosaur bones, the actual finding of those finds is impressive, but not like mind-blowingly impressive. However, during all those years, no one has found what McGill University master's student Andre Mueller found 2 years ago, a fossilized bug wing. In a newly published paper, that wing has been identified as belonging to a 75-million-year-old dragonfly. And not only that, it turns out to be a whole new species and the first dinosaur-aged dragonfly to be found in Canada. Andre Mueller told CBC Alberta about finding that needle in a haystack.
Back in 2022... I stumbled across this new site, this plant site, completely by accident. But once we discovered, like, oh, this preserves beautifully preserved leaf fossils, we began to more systematically collect at this site. And about halfway through the season, a student came up and she's like, hey, Andre, I think I got something here. And she hands me this rock, just a little fella, you know, the size of a toonie. And I kind of look at it, get my little microscope out, you know, magnifying glass. Have a look at it, like, and my heart just skips a beat. I suddenly realize, oh my goodness, this is not a leaf here. And I was really hoping, and I really hoped that it was something like an insect wing, but I was trying to be like, okay, Andre, we can't make that assumption yet. We'll have to do the whole process. But I was pretty sure that's what we had. And then once I passed it on to some colleagues who also worked with insect wings, they were like, oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what that is. And, you know, over the moon, because, well, by default, any insect that we find in Dinosaur Provincial Park is something new, because no research has really been done on these guys. And to find something so big and so distinct, we're pretty excited, because we knew we stumbled across a new find.
McGill University master's student Andre Mueller speaking to CBC reporter Eli Ritter.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.